Good morning. This morning, we're going to continue with Duncan's Kindle Koan. I may be able to finish, but I'm not sure. So, I'm going to read the previous section that we discussed yesterday. Now, if a bird or a fish tries to reach the limit of its element before moving in it, this bird or this fish will not find its way or its place. Attaining this place, one's daily life, is the realization of ultimate reality. Genjo Koan. Attaining this way, one's daily life, is the realization of ultimate reality. Genjo Koan. Since this place and this way are neither large nor small, neither self nor other, neither existing previously nor just arising now, they therefore exist thus. Thus, if one practices and realizes the Buddha way, when one gains one dharma, one penetrates one dharma, and when one encounters one action, one practices one action. So, in the next section, Dogen continues to go deeper into this last phrase. If one practices and realizes the Buddha way, when one gains one dharma, one penetrates one dharma. When one encounters one action, one practices one action. So, one dharma and one action. So, then he says, since this is a difficult part to understand. Since the place is here, and the way leads everywhere, or you could say unfolds in all directions, the reason the limits of the knowable are unknowable is simply that our knowledge arises with the and practices with the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma. What?
Right on.
The reason, since the place is here, and the way leads, the way unfolds in all directions, the reason the limits of the knowable, in other words, the limit of what you can know, right? The limits of what you can know are unknowable. The reason for that is simply that our knowledge arises with and practices with the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma. So what is the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma? That's the question that needs to be answered here in order to understand what he's talking about. The absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma is not knowing. But not knowing is the highest knowledge. Knowing is not knowing. Not knowing is knowing. Why is that? Because knowing implies a knower and something known. This is duality, the realm of duality, which we are always coursing in. And in our coursing, in our dualistic realm, there's a knower and something known, right? We all study as a knower to know something, naturally, but not here. This is all about, this is not about knowing and not knowing in the sense of a knower, a subject, and an object. The knower is the subject, and what is known is the object of the subject. There is a subject. The subject is the object is an object for the subject, but not here. This is the realm of intuition. In the realm of intuition, there is no knower and nothing known. There is just pure knowledge, which is called ignorance. The name for pure knowledge is ignorance. That's why ignorance is held in such high esteem in Buddhism. Foreseen in ignorance. It's not mental. It's pure knowledge. Pure knowing is not, is without without a knower and something known. This is the realm of just as it is, as he previously was saying. So our knowledge arises and practices with the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma. So to read the limits of the known, since the place is here, what is the place? The place is right here. This is the Dharma of, the immovable Dharma of right here. It cannot be moved. This is why the Dharma that cannot be moved is the all-pervading Dharma, which is not altered by division. So, and previously, Dzogchen was talking about the place and the way. Yesterday we talked about the place and the way. The way is the activity, and the place is here. Just as the way is the place is indivisible time, and the way is divisible time. Action. The way is action, and the place is immobility. In this case, the place of immobility is right here. In other words, the center, which is not, which is dynamically still. And the place is dynamically active within stillness. The stillness is the stillness of activity, and the activity is the activity of stillness. In other words, you're talking about Zazen. And the place is here, and the way has no boundary. It unfolds in all directions. So the reason the limits of the knowable are unknowable is simply that our knowledge arises with and practices with the absolute perfection of the Buddha Dharma. So, you know, that's why we don't have to know everything. To know one thing really thoroughly, actually, is to know everything. But it has nothing to do with knowledge. It's like, the cat that waits for the mouse to come out of the hole in the floorboard. The cat has nothing at all in his mind, but there's something that connects with that hole. There's something behind the hole that connects with that mouse, with that cat. It's called a mouse. And the cat doesn't do anything, but just sits with total attention, total dynamic stillness of attention. When the mouse comes out, just the right amount, the cat goes, catch the mouse. There's no thinking, there's no hesitation, it's simply readiness. There's nothing in between. There's not thinking or anything. It's simply direct activity. So, this is knowing without knowing. It's just pure knowledge. So, in other words, we can practice without having to know. We don't know why we practice. Somebody said to me, somebody who'd been practicing for 30 years said to me, when you find out what this is all about, will you tell me? That was Mary.
He said he would too.
Yes, I'll let you know when I find out. We can practice. This is the wonderful thing. We step into the ocean of practice. We just step into the ocean and we can do it. I talked about this the other day, I think. All we have to do is do it. The reasoning won't help us. It doesn't help you. Your mind will help. When you are in the third day of sesshin, and it's a really tough sesshin, and your legs are hurting, or your back is hurting, or whatever it is, and all these things are going on, and you don't know what to do, and so you pray. That doesn't help. You think about all the things that should help, and they don't. Nothing helps. And then you have to simply let go of all that discrimination, trying to figure it out. You can't figure it out. The only thing you can do is just, okay, let go, fly, or, you know, relax. There are two aspects of practice. One is effort, and the other is ease. Those are the two we're always bound to. This is what Dogen means when he says, when you advance, to carry yourself forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. Right? That's the active aspect. We carry ourselves forward to realize the 10,000 dharmas. That's this, holding your posture up, putting all your effort into sitting up straight, not getting that lax. You fall asleep, but you wake up. Always pursuing that effort. That's the active part. That's advancing toward the 10,000 dharmas. The passive part is that the 10,000 dharmas, allowing the 10,000 dharmas to advance and realize the self. That's the passive part. So active and passive. They're both necessary. It's not that one is right, one is wrong. To advance, carry the self forward, that's practice. But also, to let the 10,000 dharmas advance is also practice. Those are just the two sides. It's not that one is right and the other is wrong. Delusion is right. Realization, enlightenment is right. Within delusion is enlightenment. Within enlightenment is delusion. It's not that you can't get rid of them. You can't get rid of either one. What we should be trying to do is get rid of enlightenment. But we're always just trying to get rid of delusion. We're on the wrong track. Our practice is backwards. But it's better to just balance them. Right? So delusion is not bad. It simply means the active side of passivity. The active side of passivity and the passive side of activity. The feminine within the masculine and the masculine within the feminine. It's just how we balance ourselves. And when that balance is even, that's stillness. When it's not even, it's activity. It's like, this is the upright. That's total stillness. That's Buddha. And then when it leans over, the world starts going around. That's activity. So, but they're not two different things. They're just two aspects of the same thing. Dynamic stillness and dynamic activity. But if you try to figure it out, you can't. Because as soon as you start to make a division, it's no longer what it is. So you can see it, but you can't be it. You can be it, but you can't see it. I've talked about that before. You can't peek. As soon as you peek, then you fall into duality. So it's like you can't see your eyes or your teeth. So, it's subjective. The whole world is subjective. So all the objects are simply subjective, part of your subjectivity. So then he says, do not practice thinking that realization must become the object of one's knowledge and vision and be grasped conceptually. As soon as you think that you wake up and say, I just had an enlightenment experience. Okay? If you don't forget it, then you're just lost in duality. And it's no longer an enlightenment experience. It's not an enlightenment experience. As long as it falls into duality, it can be there, it can be, but you cannot define it. So all of that, so many enlightenment experiences that people have, I won't say that they're not enlightenment experiences, but the enlightenment that we talk about is much deeper than some experience. It's totally intuitive. You know it, but as soon as you think, I know it, you lose it. So, as soon as you try to see it, you lose it. Or draw a picture of it, you lose it. So we're always drawing a picture. We want a good picture of enlightenment experience. We should have enlightenment experience moment by moment. No problem. That's what our life is. But if you say, oh, that's an enlightenment experience, it's not. I'm not ready yet for questions. So, do not practice thinking that realization must become the object of one's knowledge and vision and be grasped conceptually. Even though the attainment of realization is immediately manifest, its intimate nature is not necessarily realized. Some may realize it, and some may not. So we may say, I've been practicing for 30 years and I never had an enlightenment experience. It's just that you don't realize it. You don't realize your own enlightenment experience. That's normal. Not so many people realize their enlightenment experience. Because they think enlightenment experience is something different than what they're doing. You don't realize that you're drinking your tea as an enlightenment experience. You're drinking your tea and think, gee, I wish I had an enlightenment experience. You're taking care of the garden and you think, gee, I wish I had an enlightenment experience. You're eating out of Oreo and you're like, gee, I wish I had an enlightenment experience. It's called selling water by the river. Gene Kennett named her first book Selling Water by the River. Really a good phrase, you know. Nyogen Senzaki said it's like the country bumpkin who gets on the plane and lands in New York and gets out of the plane. He said, where's New York? Of course, you wouldn't recognize it from the airport. In this phrase, the first phrase, Kazutanashi and Eikenroshi, phrased it this way: here's the place and here the way unfolds. I like that. The boundary of realization is not distinct, for the realization comes forth simultaneously with the mastering of Buddha Dharma. So that's easier to understand. The mastering of Buddha Dharma is going beyond the duality of subject and object. That's the mastering of Buddha Dharma. It's the intuitive. Intuition means directly touching without going through the process of thinking. It's like going right over the thinking process or right through without needing it. So we don't, you know, because our thinking mind works day and night, like rust. You know, we say rust never stops, never sleeps. And our thinking mind rarely, even when we're sleeping, it's still going like crazy. And when we have a problem, really good way of dealing with a problem that it's hard to solve is to forget about it. And then a month later, oh, I know the answer, because we're letting our subconscious mind figure it out. That's going deeper than our conscious mind. The unconscious mind is always figuring things out if you allow it, if we allow that to happen. And then we have an epiphany. This is why koan is good. If there's a koan that you're working on, to just let the koan incubate, like a child growing in your womb, and not trying to solve it. Don't try to solve it. Just let it work, do its work, and then you get it one day. When the stone hits the bamboo or the peach tree blossoms. Oh. So this is intuition is working in your deep subconscious. Something that is understood in your deep subconscious without the limitation of our thinking mind. Our thinking mind can really go wonderful places and do wonderful things, but its thinking mind is always discriminating. So, enlightenment experience is the experience of non-discrimination. This is why when we sit in Zazen and you allow non-discriminating mind to arise, that's enlightenment. But you don't think that, as soon as you go, oh, that's enlightenment. It's not, because then you're discriminating. So it's a little tricky. You can't peek. As soon as you peek, there's discrimination. You're trying to see something, you know, and rationalize it. As soon as you rationalize it, it's not there. So that's the trouble that we have mostly, is that we allow our discriminating mind to rationalize. And then that's why we say in Zen, it's not discursive. Whatever we say is just pointing at that thing, which is not a thing. Just pointing at the moon. But if we take it all literally, that's discriminating. So that's why we have trouble often with Zen terms and koans and all this stuff that boggles the mind, because it should boggle the mind. The mind can't get around it, because the mind always thinks in dualistic terms, discriminating terms. As soon as you start thinking with this, it's discriminating. You can't get around it. That's why a koan will often use discriminating terms to express non-discrimination. And that's why your mind gets boggled. Well, that's not logical. No, it's not logical according to our thinking mind, because we're using logical terms to express illogic or non-duality. Does the dog have the Buddha nature? No. Well, that shouldn't be. But I know the dog has Buddha nature, because everything is Buddha nature. So that's a logical term. No. Well, but in our sutra, it says no eyes, no ears, moo nose, moo eyes, moo ears, moo this, moo that, moo that. No, 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 no. No. In order to understand that, you say, I have nose, I have ears, I have eye. You could easily, just as easily say, yes, eyes, yes, ears, yes, nose, yes, tongue, no body, yes, body, yes, mind. You could just say it that way. As long as you are not discriminating. But it's better to say no, because we're always thinking in the positive side. We don't think in the negative side. So the negative side is there to stop the discriminating of the positive side. Does the dog have Buddha nature? Of course. That's the monk asked Joshu again. Does the dog have Buddha nature? Of course. You can say it either way you want. When you understand, you can say it either way. But if you don't understand, then it looks crazy. Because non-duality looks crazy to us. Because we're stuck in one side or the other. And so it's hard to realize ultimate reality. But even realizing ultimate reality, the limits of that knowledge are beyond us. So Cole had a question.
You were using the word falling over and over again.
Falling?
Yeah, falling. And I like the work on high ladders. And yesterday I was staining the upper portion of a house on a plank that was suspended by hangers between two high ladders, and it was kind of early in the morning. And the plank was still a little bit on a slant because you can't adjust the hangers yet.
Right. I remember that.
You know what I'm talking about. And and it's a little bouncy, and I noticed that I was moving really slowly because I was I was kind of like feeling out the plank and the ladder and the roller and where the bucket was and all that, and it was like, wow, this is going really, really slow. And then after a few minutes, I got the feel of the whole situation, and I just started proceeding. And I noticed the shift between those two frames of mind, and trying to understand Dogen as you're talking about it now, and have many times. I wonder if, in a way, this sort of boils down to going from thinking mind to non-dual mind, and a lot of this applies to that kind of shift.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between the two aspects of self-consciousness. So, discriminating mind makes us self-conscious. As soon as we discriminate, we are conscious of ourself as a separate self. That's discriminating. So, if you're walking a tightrope, the only way you can do the tightrope is just simply to do the activity. If you think, oh, I'm a separate being, you, oh my God. So you can't do that. The other self-consciousness is the whole universe is myself, so there's nothing to fall into. There's no place that is not the right place to be. So you can walk across the tightrope. That's forgetting self. So you came to a place where you let go of that self-consciousness and just became the plank, you, the paint, the wall, all became one piece.
Yes, and there's no thought about falling.
No, you don't think about that. I remember the first time I did that, and it was a stucco building that has little bumps on it, you know, stucco. I was holding on to those little bumps. Now, I'm going to go to the end. And here Dogen describes what practice is. It's kind of like flowers fall and weeds. Flowers fall with our wanting them not to, and weeds grow up with our not wanting them to. It's kind of like the culmination of what is real practice. Priest Pakche of Makushan was fanning himself. Mahate. You all know this. And the monk approached and said, "Sir," or whatever he said, "the nature of wind is permanent, and there's no place it does not reach." So he's making a Dharma question out of this fanning, right? That's pretty good. He's approaching the teacher and saying, "Hey, you know, why come you fanning yourself if the wind is permanent? And there's no place it doesn't reach." Saying, if Buddha nature is permanent, what are you doing? Why then must you still fan yourself? And so the master says, No, yeah, and the master says, although you understand that the nature of the wind is permanent, Suzuki Roshi said, this is just a kind of present for the monk. You know? He doesn't really understand at all. Yeah. Although you understand the nature of wind is permanent, the master replied, you don't understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? Asked the monk. And the master defends himself. And the monk bowed in deep respect. So, this is like the question of, if Buddha nature is all-pervading, and everything is Buddha nature, why do we have to do something? How can we have to practice? What need is there to practice if everything is Buddha nature? So this is, seems to be accepted as Dogen's question for a long time, because when Dogen was out on Mount Hiei, practicing the Tendai school as a young man, he learned that Buddha nature, you know, from the Parinirvana Sutra, Buddha nature is all pervading and everyone has Buddha nature. He changed that to everyone is Buddha nature, made it more intimate. Buddha nature is what everyone is, instead of has. So has is a duality. You can't have Buddha nature, you can only be it. You can be it, but you can't see it. You can see it, but not as a separate thing.
So, thinking about enlightenment and mundane activities, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, you know, the sutras say like the earth shook in the sky, I don't know, something biblical happened in the sky, and and so I'm wondering, and we have many stories like this, and the transmission of a lamp, yeah, there's many stories of enlightenment, yeah, that's very big.
Yeah.
So what is the relationship between that kind of enlightenment and the enlightenment that we're talking about in mundane existence?
You know, every story points to something. If you take everything you read literally, you have a big problem. So, a story is a story, and the story is meant to express something dynamic and big, right? So stories usually are exaggerated, but not necessarily. So, I think we have to see everything in context and understand what that means. The world shook, you know. Do you think that really happened? When Shakyamuni was sitting under the bow tree, and then pictures of all these demons, do you think those are the actual demons that he saw? So, you know, we have these pictures, and we present things in pictures. So the pictures represent something. So, I don't say that the pictures are wrong, or that they didn't actually happen exactly the way everything is depicted, but usually the stories are pointing at something dramatic. And the story that doesn't point at something dramatic is not going to be interesting. So, there's the story book, and there's the actual life. So, the fortunate thing is that with our good teachers, our good teachers help us to understand what actually is happening. And the books are kind of idealistically telling us what happened. So we have to assess, well, yeah, there are all those wonderful stories, but then there's our life, right? So it's not that that's wrong, but when you have a dramatic, you can have a very dramatic experience of enlightenment drinking a cup of tea. All you have to do is let go. That's what all of those stories are about, is letting go of your discriminating mind. But what the problem with the stories is that they lead us into thinking that we have to have this dramatic experience in order to have an experience of enlightenment. That's the problem with those stories. You don't have to have that dramatic experience that equals someone else's dramatic experience. Like, what is a dramatic experience? I mean, dramatic experience for one person is not a dramatic experience for somebody else. Maybe an ordinary experience for somebody else. Someone's ordinary experience, experienced by someone else, can be very dramatic. Akata.
So you said that as soon as we reflect on an experience, it's no longer that, right? So that then duality and discrimination come in. So my question is, how do you, because I've never had an enlightenment experience.
We just had one.
So how do you know you've had it if you're not there? Because the whole point is you're not there when you're having it, right? So is it that you realize you weren't there?
Yeah, that's like Woody Allen saying, I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens. No, I'm just pointing at something. Don't take the words too literally. I don't want, this kind of discussion, you're getting into, like, there, not there, you know, it's too, trying to pin something down literally. It's like you have to kind of get it. The way it's dramatized is that it's like walking in the fog, and unawares your clothes get wet. Unaware, you resolve, That's the big experience. Very dramatic. Oh, my clothes are wet. Wow, who would have thought? So, I think it's all misleading, because we tend, when we get focused on that kind of experience, as what you experience that, we think, well, what's happening now is nothing. That's the problem. What's happening now, if you really understood what was happening now, if you really had a normal experience of what's happening now, it would be unusual. But we're always thinking about what's happening instead of just allowing it to happen. We're always thinking about it. It's okay. But, you know, it's all, that's why we said Zazen. Zazen, it's all there in Zazen. But we don't even believe that. I'm just sitting here and nothing's happening. You know, we don't recognize that the nothing that's happening is what it is. Yes, that's a negative part. It's important. We're always thinking of the positive part. But it's the negative part that's important. It's not that the positive part isn't important. That's, you know, we're always thinking in terms of pursuing the 10,000 things. The negative part is letting the 10,000 things come forward and verify the self. But the negative part is not laziness. It's simply being open. Just being open to everything without discriminating. And that's what sadhana is, being totally open without discriminating. Pain, pleasure, right, wrong, good, bad, it all drops away.
Thank you for your teaching.
Okay.
Suzuki Roshi said, don't be in too big a hurry to get enlightened. You may not like it.
That's a good, I really like that one a lot. Because we think, well, I want something that I like.
I hope this isn't too graphic, but women, when we're girls, we begin to menstruate and we get cramps. And every month we have cramps.
Yeah.
And it happens 100 times, hundreds of times. Finally, we're lucky, we get to give birth.
Yeah.
And it's the same pain.
Oh, yeah.
And our body, it is.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. And same thing's happening. You know, especially same pain, much greater pain. And your body recognizes it, though. Body says, I've done this before, I've been through this, I know this. Except this time, it's big, and you have a baby most of the time. But your body recognizes the pain. So I wonder if enlightenment is something that in small things.
Well, giving birth is an enlightening experience, of course.
Yes, but what I'm trying to say is that your body recognizes it.
Yes.
So is it possible that in enlightenment you may finally recognize that it has happened before?
You realize it's been happening all the time. I didn't realize it.
Right.
Yeah, that's enlightenment. It's been happening all the time. I didn't realize it. And I'm just realizing that it happens. It's been going on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how come I didn't see that before? Because even if I thought it was that, I'd never think this is what. Yeah.
I see a connection between Matt's question and the rest of this discussion. For me, the dramatic, Baroque descriptions that we have of enlightenment experiences or in some of the Chinese or some of the Indian sutras are a way in which I recognize that picking up dog shit is an enlightenment experience. That the ordinary can have that same sense of wonder that is profound as the ground shaking and the...
Mm-hmm. Right. That's right. The ordinary is the most ground shaking. If we really understood, if we really experienced the ordinary, because the ordinary is totally extraordinary. That's the problem. That's why our practice is focused on the ordinary. You know, that's why it's focused on just the ordinary. Eating, you know. Eating and shitting. The Zen master says, what is the way? Just sitting on Mount Dayugo. Eating out of my Oreo cake and shitting. That's all there is to it.
There's something about practice, may not be Zen practice, but the ordinary is like an amazing appreciation for the ordinary. It's like that ability becomes exercise.
Well, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This might be taking it too literally, but you said the pain and, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it drops away. What does that mean?
Well, that means you accept it all. Drops away means you totally accept it. You know, everything, in non-duality, everything swallows its opposites.
Yeah, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Drop it away.
Yeah, that could be misleading. But that's Dogen's term, dropping body and mind. But dropping body and mind means completely exerting body and mind. So there's no opposites, nothing opposing, not an opposite. There's not opposites that would create duality. So, of course, we live in duality, but enlightenment is understanding the non-duality of duality.
I've been thinking about the sheen as a metaphor, that all the scrabbling and fighting I do with the schedule and the resistance I feel and all the inner turmoil is that fighting. And then finally there can sometimes come a moment where you just give up and kind of surrender. Say, all right, then here I am.
That's it. Here I am. You surrender. Yes. And when you surrender, you find your freedom.
Right.
You think that surrendering is to be dominated, but actually it's to find our freedom.
Is that when Suzuki Roshi said, it doesn't get better later?
Well, that's right. It's the place of no hope. It just give up all hope, because hope is tied to continuing the way you are. Or the what you want. Something better. There's going to be something better. There's nothing better than this. Oh God, my legs are hurting. There's nothing better than this. This is the best there is. Ouch.
I think this has to do with what we're talking about, but I'm not sure. I'm wondering if a robber shoots someone and kills them, is that action that robber's taken, is that an enlightenment
experience? No, that's creating evil karma. It's not enlightenment. There's no enlightenment there. It's darkness. Why would you say that?
I think because sometimes I feel like I hear a saying that everything is dharma.
Well, everything is included in dharma, but that doesn't mean that everything is none. It says is okay to do. Doesn't mean everything is okay to do.
So can it be dharma and not be okay to do?
Well, dharma is like all-inclusive, right? And so within all-inclusiveness is good and bad, right and wrong. Within non-duality is duality. So it's not one or the other. It's not like, oh, we're leaving behind duality and just do non-duality. No. Non-duality encompasses everything. There's nothing left out of the big mind. That doesn't mean there's no good, but within that, there's right and wrong, good and bad, and karma. When you kill somebody, there's karma. There's no doubt about it. So, see, we fall into one side or the other. That's the problem. Just stop thinking. duality, non-duality. Duality is just, you know, is no better than non-duality. Non-duality is no better than duality. It's just that if you want reality, you have to understand non-duality. Not better. Duality ignorance is as important as enlightenment. That's what we keep saying. That's what we said. Ignorance is as important as enlightenment. To carry the self forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. It's just as important as enlightenment.
moment of learning to ride a bicycle.
Yes.
But my mind knows that it's totally impossible.
Yeah.
There is no balance. There is no, I mean, you cannot. And well, somehow the falling forward into right now is totally, the body knows how to do it.
Yes.
The being moves through space. Nobody's riding a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels fabulous.
That's right.
With all the cuts and scrapes.
When nobody's riding the bicycle, right, yeah. then everything's working just fine. That's right. That's true. The body knows how. Yeah.
But you can't enjoy it too much, or you might run into a grating.
Well, you can't let
your face.
That's right. So you have to use discriminating mind in order to steer. To know where you're going, you have to use discriminating mind. That's right. So discriminating mind, you know, is help. You know, is the way we get through this complete world.
That's a good answer to Dee's question.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing.
In fact, if we get too high on bicycling or anything else, we're going to invariably.
That's why you can't stay in you can't stay in emptiness. You have to get into form. So form is the way we experience emptiness. Emptiness is the way we experience form. But yet, form is just form. Emptiness is just emptiness. And
I've been coming to Zendos for many years, and even no matter what I hear and think or say, it seems like I keep discovering that the motivation to make effort is I want ease. I want something.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Then I just, you know, I'm always trying to become a better person and, you know, be more whatever. And I keep discovering that that's really what I'm doing this for.
Yeah. That's why you have so many questions.
Yeah. And then, you know, I find I'm just so tired. I don't want to get up.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to sit here and make an effort when I'm uncomfortable. And if I don't have these motivations, why will I do that? Why will I make an effort?
Yeah. Well, my motivation, I never thought about that. I never thought about, you know, if I do this, I'll get enlightened or anything like that. It's never been my motivation. My motivation is, how can I do this? It's just kind of a challenge, like, how can I do this? That's the only motivation I've ever had. Is how can I do this?
Do what?
Yeah. How can I do what? Yeah. I've never blamed the practice at all. You know, there's something wrong with this practice. You know, because it makes me hurt. So my motivation has been, how can I really do this? And I'm sitting in there, and the sharks are eating my legs. You know, how can I do this? That's all that's ever been motivating me, is how can I do this? I never thought about beyond that. So that's always kept me busy, you know, for 43 years or something. it's going to be very busy, actually. How can I do this? How can I do this? How can I do this? What am I going to get, or where does it go, or something like that? Just how is not why. Why is not the right question. How is that question? How, not why. There's not even what. Just how. When there's something in front of you, how do I deal with that? That's all. How do I deal with this? How do I deal with this? That's practice. If you want to know what a practice is in any situation, is how do I deal with this? That's all. That's simple. That's all there is to practice. How do I deal with this? When I sit in the Dokusan room and everybody comes to see me, I'm not thinking about anything. Just whatever appears in front of me, how do I deal with this? That's all. When I'm driving my car down the street, how do I deal with this? Where am I going, by the way? When I go to the other room, why did he come in here? Actually, that doesn't happen to me. I always know why. Just how do I deal with it? That's all there is. That's practice. Then, without expecting anything, this is faith practice. And faith types and doubt types. Maybe I'll talk about that tomorrow. Faith doubts and types and doubts. Dogen and Suzuki Roshi are both faith types. That's why I can easily identify with their teachings. Because I'm a faith type. I've never had any doubts at all. A little doubt maybe here and there, but never really had any doubts. But some people just always doubting, you know. What? Why? What is this about? I just never had that person. Yeah.
So, if you were a doubter, would there be a doubt type teacher?
Like Rinzai style is more like doubt type. Soda style is more like faith type. Yeah. But good, it's good for faith types to have doubt type teachers sometimes. And it's good for doubt types to have faith type teachers sometimes. So if you're a doubt type, you're lucky to be here.
I
don't think I am.
I don't think so.
Well, no, I don't think so. I think he's both, you know, kind of on the cusp. Maybe he has elements of both. So, it's interesting. Just, the way we are. Probably really pass that down, but. We do non-dualistic practice all the time without knowing it. Because the basic non-dualistic practice is this. That's why we do it all the time. We bow to the Gamasio, we bow to this. Why come these guys are bowing to everything all the time? Because it's a basic non-dualistic practice. Buddha bodhisattvas, arhats, pratyeka buddhas, devas, or whatever you want to call it, and then the hell realm, the animal realm, the fighting demon realm, the heavenly realm, and the animal realm. And so we take these two sides, these two divisions, and put them together as one thing. That's all. And then we so here we go. When you bow, just let go of everything. You put them together and just let go of everything. That's devotion. That's faith. It's like, I'm letting go of everything. I'm letting go of all my stuff, all my doubts, all my anger, ill will, delusion, greed, hate, and bow. So then that's an enlightened act. You do it all the time. But we think that enlightenment is something out there. It's a big thing, you know, when the lightning slows down. It's just our ordinary life. That's what Gyanjo Koan is about, our ordinary life. He doesn't talk about anything spectacular. Just talks about how it is in our ordinary life. This is called The Way of Everyday Life. That's the name of this book. The Way of Everyday Life. You and your children and your spouse and your work and your walking and your eating and your... What it's about the enlightened activity of your everyday life. But if you want something spectacular, you should go practice someplace else. But something spectacular can still happen to you. Like making this wonderful cup of water. I always drink this cup of water, even if I'm not thirsty, because somebody put it there for me.